Let's pray. Thank you, Lord, for this day. Thank you for this opportunity to be here at Faith Builders, and we pray a blessing, Lord, on this day and on this class. We ask, Lord, that you would help us to understand difficulties in relation to this subject. Help us to be compassionate, loving, not overly judgmental. Lord, we just thank you for each child that you brought into our life, and we pray that we would be able to bless them and encourage them so they can be useful in your kingdom someday. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, well, welcome to this workshop. I believe I'm attracted to this workshop title because it is my initials, Anthony Dean Hurst. And I'm not sure what to do with the last D, but anyhow, I think I have some connection to this subject. I entitled this the ADHD question, not the ADHD answer, or the ADHD conclusion, because it is a question that I suppose will never be fully answered for a couple reasons. Number one, it is very complex, and it's always hard to answer a question or resolve an issue when there's so many, many opinions. And so I hold my opinions lightly because I am sure that some of you will walk away and say, he is wrong. In fact, I'd be disappointed if it wouldn't be that way. Because you shouldn't believe just everything everybody people say. I would welcome your questions as we go along. Just say, well, what about this? Or I was told this, etc. So feel free to do that. You, I'm sure, welcome that in your classrooms. Raise your hand and just say, I have a question here. Could we talk about this? It might be something that I missed completely, and you expected to hear something from that. So please don't hesitate to raise your hand if you have a question. Would you raise your hand, please, if you need a copy? And then I'll take a copy myself, Matthew. Thank you. All right, well, let's get into this as far as a little bit of a description. And again, this description is so broad, but I want to talk about it just as what would be considered a fairly general definition for, of course, attention deficit hyperactive disorder. I assume you know somewhat what the those letters mean. So under general definition and related issues, I will give you three words that, I'm sure you've come across if you've done any amount of reading or study on this. Three things that seem to characterize a person who I'm going to use at this point the term has ADHD, and we'll talk about it later if we should be using that term or not. All right. So we're just going to say has ADHD because that's just the normal way of talking about this. All right. So here would be a few things that you would particularly notice with a child that is diagnosed with ADHD. It would be things like inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity or impulsiveness. All right, so inattention, they have a problem paying attention. Hyperactivity, you know what that would mean, of course. Often we just say it, they're hyper. And then impulsivity, very impulsive. Not a lot of thinking before particular actions. Interestingly enough, this is considered to be 2 to 4 times more common in boys than in girls. That's just interesting to note and does make me wonder. So the ladies are here to figure out the men or the boys. Just touch briefly on some related issues, and this thing crisscrosses and grays in ways that, of course, we don't have time to talk about, neither could I fully help us to understand because I don't understand it myself. But we use terms like learning disabilities. So a term like learning disability simply focuses on a very, very wide spread of particular handicaps sometimes, or simply particular challenges of a student to learn, just learning disabilities. So a person that has a learning disability is not necessarily also a very hyperactive child. But those things crisscross because often a child with some of these challenges do also have some learning disabilities. So that's why they enter in books often crisscross this information and talk about it in the same paragraph. Also, words like just attention deficit order is sometimes used, ADD, attention deficit order. So we're taking out that H letter, the hyperactivity aspect. And so there would be some children who've been diagnosed accordingly, neurobiological disorder, ADD instead of ADHD. And then, of course, the most modern writing often brings in other concerns that you might see in some of these children, like ODD. This would be oppositional defiance disorder. I'm glad that's a disorder, aren't you? Oppositional defiance disorder. So we can understand that once we start down this path of labeling children, at some points, and I would say fairly early on, we run into some big questions as to, now wait a minute, is this really what to call this? Oppositional defiance disorder. So this child would be characterized with a child who just doesn't like authority and talks back quickly and is very brash and gets angry and even violent. And so we understand that this range of terms covers quite a range of behavior, of course, and some of them we step back and say, no, wait a minute, what are we saying here? And we want to try to wade through at least some of those questions today. Back to ADHD, let me just give you a little list that if a child would be taken to a psychiatrist or to the doctor and say, my child is struggling, 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old, here would be a possible checklist, and there's loads of these checklists. You can find them on the internet. You can find them in books. They're all over the place. And this would be some things that would be looked at and ask the parent or the teacher. Say, is this true of the child? Often fidgets with hands or feet or squirms in the seat. Has difficulty remaining seated when required to. Is easily distracted by extraneous stimuli, like things outside, noises around them, other people. Has difficulty awaiting turn in games or group situations. Often blurts out answers to questions before they have been completed. Has difficulty following through on instructions from others. Has difficulty sustaining attention in tasks or play activities. Often shifts from one uncompleted project to another. Has difficulty playing quietly. Often talks excessively. Often interrupts or intrudes on others. Often doesn't seem to be listening in what is being said. How many students do you have like that? I've seen quite a few through the years. So what I want you to understand right up front is that this is not a list, that if you can put a check mark at a certain amount of the things, this child has ADHD, okay? This is not a very diagnosable issue because that list is obviously just a list of behaviors of which you are observing the child to be in their behavior. So a lot of subjectivity here that we'll draw from that fact as we move along. All right, so that's just some general definition, especially those three things and related issues, the ADD, the LD, or learning disorders. Let's go to some possible physical factors. Now, again, I would really love to know what's going through your mind. I'm going to give some things that books would simply say. Here are some things that maybe contribute to this whole scenario. I am not giving any of these as this is true. That's why I wrote the word possible. And we find a huge range of what people believe could be contributing factors to this type of behavior or problem. All right. So let's talk about a few of them. If the mother smoked or drank during pregnancy. Now, see, I would say that one has some credibility as far as contributing to the behavior of the child. Again, depends what you're doing with this now. But if the mother smoked or drank during pregnancy, I think we've all worked with children from a difficult past, and we notice a connection between what they experienced as a child or even during the pregnancy of the mother with that child and certain behaviors. Head injuries, being exposed to toxins, like especially lead. That one comes up repeatedly. Certain toxins that the child would have been exposed to, especially lead. That's why there's lots of concern about lead paint in older buildings. especially schools and child care centers, etc. Genetic component is often cited as a factor. There's a genetic thing here, like father, like son, and so this thing is passed on from one generation to the next. Poor diet, very controversial. The Feingold's diet, I'm sure if you read it all, you would have come across that multiple times. And there's some people who say, oh, that just really, really unlocked, I mean, that really changed, unlocked the secrets to this problem. So there's other people who say that absolutely has nothing to do with it whatsoever. I'm trying to give you a range here, folks, so you can take your pick, what you're willing to believe. Pesticides has been cited as causing a problem. Pesticides, foods a child would have eaten that would have been sprayed or taken in through the air, pesticides. And according to some, it has a lot to do with the difficulties in their past, traumatic experiences, that if they could just reverse those, I shouldn't say reverse those, but if they could deal with the memory, the problem would be taken care of. And some of that will kind of sweep through a few of those things later. So those are just given as some possible, by the professionals, some possible physical factors that play into as to why does this child have this unusual behavior or difficult behavior? Why are they so hyperactive? Why can't they pay attention, etc.? So now a question that I think we need to think about, and that is there a possible, is there a physical problem here? And here's the question that I'm not going to try to fully answer today. Is there a physical problem? Why is that such an important question? I think it's an important question for various reasons. That becomes an important question. Let me just cite a few things. First of all, just out of interest, as to man has always been looking for a cure to behavior that could be a drug or a pill or something to take care of this problem. So just to read you an interesting little note here, because maybe you've been taking some of these drugs, actually. This goes way back to the 1800s. Here in America, an Atlanta, Georgia pharmacist named John Pemberton came up with a formula for a cure-all tonic in 1886. He claimed it would cure depression, lack of concentration, so there's your inattention, headaches, and a host of minor ailments. The tonic formula was purchased 5 years later by Asa Candler, another pharmacist, and added to carbonated water, producing a soda fountain drink. By the turn of the century, Coca-Cola could be purchased in virtually every city in America, Hawaii, Canada, and Mexico, and contained its main active ingredient, the substance after which it was named, cocaine. It wasn't until the second decade of the 20th century that the cocaine was replaced by another powerful stimulant drug, caffeine. Is that why you drink Coke? That's not a swat at Coca-Cola at all. But interesting how man has always been looking for an answer out there somewhere as to what to do with this problem. Another just interesting thing, this is a little bit off the subject, but you might come across this, and that would be a book like this. I bought this book because it said, A Different Perception. This is particular ADD, and this man would claim that this whole problem, especially the attention deficit thing, is actually an evolutionary product. And so if you go way back, there would have been the people who were farmers, and they were very focused. And there were the hunters who needed to have a lot of, you know, be observing everything. And so we actually have a hunter group of people among us who live in a farming community. And so, and we have farming schools. And these hunters have a difficulty because they ought to be out there, you know, they are more alert to what's going on around them. And then we try to put them in a farmer school, and they don't fit the culture and they don't fit the system. So he would come out on the evolutionary and say that the problem, yes, is physical, but it actually has a lot of evolutionary roots. And so if we understand that, that takes away the pressure. Just an interesting perspective, one that we probably at least would have some grave questions about, I would hope. All right, I'm going to go into the function of neurotransmitters, and this is probably not exactly what you were expecting, But I'm going to do this as for the reason, especially of those who would like to try to understand, what do drugs do to the mind? What's going on here as far as you take a drug, caffeine even? And that way we can tie the whole riddling question into this thing before we move into just some more practical considerations. Now, this might feel to you what it feels like when we as teachers jump into the middle of a subject and the people have, your students have no idea where you are. There's not enough of things strung together to make any sense. So I'm doing this a little bit to you, but obviously to try to build from the brain anatomy into this discussion or to where I am right here would simply not be what this class is about. So I'm kind of jumping into the middle of a brain question here and trying to help you understand something. It will feel a little disconnected. So I hope you can forbear, but that's what I almost needed to do. So just a few things about your brain. You have about 100 billion cells in your brain. 100 billion, each making approximately 1,000 connections. That is where intelligence lies. When Einstein died, they would have liked to see, what is it about his brain that he was so intelligent? So he agreed that after he dies, they can have his brain, and they can look at it and see what is maybe different about his brain. So they, after he died, they took his brain and weighed about what other people's brains did, about 3 pounds. It's not in the size of the brain, unfortunately, for some of us that have a big head. You know, it really is not helping us out on that one. So they took a little slice of the brain, and they found that the intercellular connections, which would simply mean the cells, these 100 billion cells of the brain, their ability to talk to each other is what makes you smart. There is a tremendous amount of this network that happens when a child is very, very small, which I think helps us to understand why children who are not exposed to that stimuli in cultures, countries, situations at very young, and 1, 2, 3, 4, sometimes don't build maybe that intercellular connection, and there's consequences sometimes are for a lifetime. I'm saying that very kindly, but it makes a lot of sense to me as you look around. Because that is what we could call brain power. It's the ability for the cells to talk to each other and communicate. This is so complex that if you could take all the phone systems of the entire world and make them as small and complex as your brain, it would fit into a thimble. All right? So in your head, you have way more connections than the entire phone system of the world. That allows us to bring thoughts and to put this all together in ways that are truly mysterious. And people don't even understand that. Study the brain for a lifetime. All right? But I just want you to appreciate the complexity of the brain. So how does the brain communicate with each other? How does it talk from one cell to the next? Well, they discovered that actually they communicate through a little bit of space between the cells. Now, again, I didn't take time to even draw a whole brain cell. But a cell cannot talk directly. Okay, let me back up to this one thing. You understand that your brain runs with electricity, right? There's a few watts up there. And so there is electrical currents in our brain. That's how the message is sent from a cell out the axon, which I have drawn here, the word axon up in the top right. So an electrical impulse communicating something, or not quite sure what, if it's a letter or a word or a feeling, probably just part of that because it's all compiled then to create whatever we're creating, or a visual percept or words or sentences or understanding or what you're thinking right now. Anyhow, we have an electrical impulse coming down the axon, wanting to send that impulse to another dendrite. Okay, so this one cell, which its main part of the cell would be up higher, is also sending out messages to many other cells. But so we're just getting this down to one cell, talking to one cell, which is a huge simplification, of course, of what goes on. But anyhow, we have the electrical impulse coming down, and then we have the dendrite of another cell. Okay, so the axon of a cell takes a message away. The dendrite of another cell receives that information. So it's just two parts to a cell. One cell talking to another. The axon to the dendrite. But they don't touch each other. So that little shock can't go across there. And it keeps going. Instead, there is a little synaptic cleft, which is, of course, extremely small. If you've got 100 billion cells talking to approximately 1,000 others, this space is incredibly small, but it is there and it is important. That little bit of space, the synaptic cleft, is now where the whole drug thing comes in. Neurotransmitters, I'm sure you heard of that term already. Neurotransmitters is the chemical. Some of them are hormones. Some of those are other types of molecules. That electrical charge, the red arrow, somehow hits those little dots, which are like vesicles of neurotransmitters, of which there's about 50 different kinds in the brain. They're still understanding those. And it stimulates it to release those through the membrane at the end, right here at this point, and into the synaptic cleft. And then it's received by the dendrite, which would be like those X's. It's received. And then that sends the impulse on its journey. That only takes about a thousandth of a second. That's happening at thousands or millions of places in your brain all the time. But that little space in there, the synaptic cleft, is that area that is not electrical. Electrical comes to the end of the axon, stimulates the release of the neurotransmitters, which then stimulates the next part, which is the dendrites. Now, I know that's just jumping in the middle. It makes you wonder a million questions. I hope it does anyhow. You can research those things out. So what do drugs do? Well, they can do a few things. They can stimulate the brain to produce more of those neurotransmitters. More. That would be a stimulant drug. You might know that most drugs largely fit into one of two groups. Either they are a stimulant or they are an antidepressant. And I'll try to briefly explain both of those. So a stimulant actually causes more, particularly certain kinds of neurotransmitters to be released, particularly dopamine. You might have heard of that word, dopamine. One of the ones that they would say play a lot into this ADHD issue. And that would be in the frontal part of your brain. This is where you really do your thinking. You don't do a whole lot of thinking back here. You do most of your thinking in the frontal part of the brain. So they think that Ritalin stimulates the frontal part of the brain, certain parts of it, where you make decisions, etc., to produce more dopamine. Now, you would think that would mean more hyperactive, yet. I mean, we've got more stimulant going on. Well, instead, they would say it allows the brain to catch up to the body. It allows the person to think better and be in more control of their body because they can think and keep up with what their body wants to do in their hyperactive moments. And obviously, there is an effect of the Ritalin that is positive in that way. I'm not saying it is not. But that's one way a drug might work, is it could cause more of those red dots to be secreted, I guess you could say, or produced by the cell. The other side, interestingly enough, something like Prozac is considered an SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So if a person takes something like Prozac, or I believe Paxil might also fit into that category, some type of antidepressant, that's a little bit of a that word might make us misunderstand really what's happening. But let me just show you very briefly what is happening at that point. This here needs to be cleaned up almost immediately. These extra neurotransmitters that are floating around that did not get received in the receiver get caught up and repackaged in what's called reuptake. So if there's a drug that can block the reuptake activity right here, block it off, it will allow that serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine, I mean, all kinds of those type of neurotransmitters, to not be retaken, and it stays in the synaptic cleft a little more, and it gets received a little longer. So, in effect, you end up with more effect of the neurotransmitter. So you're going to have more neurotransmitters, it's just sustained in the synaptic cleft. You know what? That really feels good. That feels good. If it's certain kinds of drugs. That's exactly what cocaine does. But in another area of the brain, but that's called the rewards endogenous system, the part that makes you really feel good about things, all right? It plays on that part of the brain, and it blocks it. So it blocks the reuptake, allowing certain types of neurotransmitters to stay in the brain a little extra long, and it gives you a high. Well, what does the brain do about this? Well, depending on what kind of drug, it adjusts. While it feels good to the person, the brain doesn't know what to do with all this extra neurotransmitter, whatever it might be. And so it will maybe blunt their receivers. What do you think happens the next time somebody takes cocaine? They need a little more to get that same rush, and a little more. That's why it's addictive, because the brain is adjusting quickly to try to do something about this unusual amount of neurotransmitters in the synaptic cleft. Now, does Ritalin do the same thing? Well, they don't really know. Ritalin is so much smaller, has so much less of an effect on the brain. And so I don't want to equate cocaine to Prozac and Ritalin. But it does help you understand, hopefully, a little bit what is going on. Any drug, including caffeine, affects how your brain is handling the neurotransmitters. Are there any questions? None. Wow, that must have been simpler than I thought. So let's go to the question of drugs carefully. Number one, it is important for you to understand, and I want to make something very, very clear here at the beginning. It is important for you to understand that a doctor cannot do a test and say, you know what, there's a chemical problem in your brain. You have a chemical imbalance. You've all heard of that, I'm sure. I'm saying that kindly, but I'm saying that because I think you should know that for yourself personally and as you work with people. The doctor cannot prick you, scan your brain, or do any other type of test and say, you have a chemical imbalance. Let's do this. And that will straighten out the imbalance in your brain and bring about the relief that you're looking for. Do drugs alter the chemical balance? Yes, absolutely. But not in a very predictable way. That's why a bottle of Prozac will say this could make you suicidal. Because to some people, it plays differently on the brain than for other people for reasons that doctors do not understand. So when they take a child before the doctor and they describe this list of fidgeting and not paying attention, the doctor's taking a guess as to what is going on with his child. Should we give him Ritalin or not? They have no idea why the child behaves the way they do, but they might try Ritalin. It will adjust the neurotransmitters of the brain. It may bring some relief to the relief the parents are looking for. Does it fix a problem in the brain? Does somebody need this drug? That's where we get very debatable. Do they need this drug? Is there a way to prove that there's actually a chemical imbalance in the brain? Absolutely not. Might a child have some differences of how their brain functions than somebody else? I would say that is possible. Could Ritalin bring a relief to some of those symptoms? Obviously it has. I've worked with enough of children that I realize it does make a difference in the behavior of children. It most certainly does make a difference. Parents need to make a call on some of those things. So let's come back to the question. Is ADHD a medical condition, or does it describe a behavior? I want you to think of that a little bit, and that would be under summarizing the definition and factors of ADHD. I just want to think about that briefly, and then we're going to move into some other aspects of this whole question. The question really is ADHD a disease? Is it like Parkinson's or some kind of dementia or Alzheimer's disease? See, it is clear that there is actually a breakdown of neural pathways of the brain in Parkinson's. Did you know that somebody with Parkinson's might take, I think it is Ritalin? Because that plays on parts of the brain where it stimulates the production of dopamine and they can function better. Brain scans show that there is a breakdown of nerve tissue. There's not enough of dopamine. They will stimulate the dopamine. I have a friend that is doing that, and it actually helps his walking. It is traceable. So it does do something to the brain. That is obviously from a medical perspective, to take a drug. But the question is now, with these children, is this a behavior or is this a medical condition? Can we know? Why does it matter? Well, let me read you one reason it matters. This would be a book called ADHD, A Path to Success, a revolutionary theory and new innovation in drug-free therapy, which I find many books, many articles that are working for something that is drug-free for various reasons, and maybe we'll look at those just briefly later. But think of where this question leads us. If individuals are not individually in control of their emotions, behavior, and psychological changes, but are responsive to their current and past social situations, it is deceptive and ineffective fiction to try to induce the individual to take responsibility for controlling his feelings. We act as if he has willful control over feelings in the same way he has willful control over the movement of his arm. The illusion of personal responsibility is seductive because individual action can often solve minor problems. Because we're satisfied with the results for minor circumscribed problems, we generalize the strategies of personal responsibility to bigger, more chronic, or complicated issues. This often does not work. The notion of rigid responsibility for one's own feelings and behavior is a damaging cultural fiction. It may be neat and convenient, but it does not provide us an effective model upon which to base change strategies. This writer would maintain that ADHD is certainly a behavior that is a response to what they faced in the past, and because it's a response for what they faced in the past, they are not responsible for what they are doing. But you would rather take the situation that has caused them this behavior. You would record things like, it's all okay, school's okay, don't be afraid. You would play that in their sleep and find that the child no longer shows these kind of behaviors. That's his thinking on the issue. So coming back to this question, why does it matter? I believe it matters what you personally, as you grapple with this question, as you work with children in your school, it matters because we come back to a very central question, and that is the child responsible for their behavior? Are they? If the child is not responsible, that alters how you handle the situation, of course, and discipline, etc. If the child is responsible for their behavior, then they're responsible. But see, if it is a physical problem, only or primarily, that does reduce the child's responsibility, doesn't it? Yeah. Are you with me? Do you understand what I'm saying? If the child is not responsible for what's going on in their brain, then they're not responsible for the behavior. Just like you would never take somebody with Parkinson's disease and say, well, why can't you walk better? You're responsible for not walking nice and steady. Well, of course not. They have a medical condition. They have something that is wrong. They cannot. So hence we come back to the question repeatedly with these children and say, what's going on? See, it's the ADHD question. I'm asking a lot of questions. Well, in the medical field, number one, it's interesting to note that all doctors, I believe, or most, I would assume, would agree that Ritalin is way over-prescribed. That tells us something, doesn't it? If the doctors say, you know what, we got a certain percent of children in the public school on Ritalin, and it shouldn't be that high, that tells us something. That tells us that there are children who, according to the checklist, have ADHD, but according to what they think, the problem is not medical, it's behavioral and training. Does that make some sense? Because that is the professional evaluation of doctors saying there is way too many. We just can't tell when Ritalin is warranted and when Ritalin will help because of the bad home situation and discipline. We can't tell the difference. I mean, the mom comes in, the teacher comes in, fidgets, yes. Talks back, uh-huh. Talks incessantly, yes. Doesn't follow through project, uh-huh. I mean, I have 6 children. I could fill out a little list here, and at least, you know, sometimes, you know, out of 10, I maybe could come up to 5 or 6 and might cross that line. It is so subjective, and doctors grapple with that because there's no test. But the question matters because it depends on what you're going to do with the situation, how you're going to discipline, how you're going to handle it. So I think we can make that conclusion, that number one, there is certainly more cases that are more diagnosis than what would clearly be a medical condition. So I would say, let's remember that what I believe, and I'm going to say this carefully, while I do believe there are those physical factors
Okay, how do I want to say this? I didn't write this exactly how I want to say it. While I believe these physical factors do at times play in, I think it would be unfair as you look around and you see where you find these problems showing up more often, more predictable, how, when, and where they show up. I believe it would be unfair to say that there's no physical components to this whatsoever. It is entirely discipline. I think that would be unfair. That would be, I'm now finally saying a little bit what I think. However, we cannot distinguish between when is that the case and when is it maybe entirely the teaching and the training. This thing blurs. Maybe sometimes it's some of both. Maybe sometimes it's predominantly the one. The question is, what are you as a teacher? What difference does it make to you as a teacher? See, even if there is a physical component, does that, in the mind of a Christian, remove responsibility for their behavior? That is something that you're going to need to grapple with. Even if there is a physical factor, this child, the pregnancy, etc., I know that, or there was a, I know that, okay. Does that make a difference as to how you handle that child? Well, maybe in some ways it does, but the bottom line still is going to be, from a Christian perspective, that the child is responsible for their behavior and we need to guide them to better behavior. In relation to Ritalin, I would just make this comment that I think it would be wise for you as a teacher to respect the decision of the parent. Respect the decision. I've worked with children that have been in Ritalin. I'll admit there's times that I've wondered if it was the best. There are other times that I think the parents, with a good motive, have probably made that decision, and I'm going to let that with them to make that decision, rather than us as teachers reaching into the home and saying, hey, you shouldn't be doing that. It is not your child, even though you deal with the issues at school. I believe motive is a big issue in this. I believe parents sometimes have been motivated to use Ritalin because they were embarrassed with their child's behavior, or they're just so sick and tired and weary of the battle. So, we finally have some rest at home. That's a little different motivation than a parent who says, you know what, for school hours, this is really creating a difficulty at school. And we'll give a small dose of Ritalin to make it through the day, allow a higher concentration at school, and things just go a little better. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying there are motivational things there that parents need to grapple with. And I would call you to respect that, no matter what it is. And never get a swirl going in your school or on your faculty or in your community that so-and-so's on Ritalin, I can't believe it, that is so unbiblical, etc. There are parents that have been extremely hurt by that. I've talked to them. I know that. By the distrust that was generated in their church community or school community because of how they chose to handle it. But finally, they are the ones that are dealing with the child. It doesn't mean you have to agree, but it does mean you need to respect their decision and be very careful with the judgmental statements that you might be tempted to make. All right, so let's go to distinguishing between physical and spiritual issues in behavior. Now, I'm separating that from physical versus spiritual causes, okay? So we're going to now look at ADHD as a behavior, not as a condition, okay? I might say the things the same way, but I want to flip it to that a little more. I want to look at the behavior of the child now. What's going on in the behavior of the child? I'm not anymore looking at reasons. Is it discipline? Is it physical? We discussed that. We left that in a little bit of a blur, saying possibly both at times, predominantly one sometimes. But let's go back down to, at the end of the day, I'm not really responsible to make that judgment call. I'm responsible to work with what I have in my classroom. So job number one, I think, is so important, to try to somehow separate between physical and spiritual issues in behavior. So it goes to this kind of a question. As you look at your child's behavior in your classroom, to somehow have the emotional fortitude and the ability to back away and say, what is physical components to this child's behavior? It's just the fidgeting, it's the looking out the window, versus what is spiritual, in other words, morally right versus wrong. Now, some of that tends to blur at times, I realize, but it is important that you take time to maybe draw some boxes and put the child's behavior in boxes. because it will alter, I believe, how you deal with those problems. Let's talk about a few things here now, or examples. I would believe on the physical side is that endless bouncing the finger and the foot. Is that sinful? Ed Welch makes a comment in his book, and I didn't bring that book along, Blame It on the Brain. You really should read a book like that if you want to do any exploring of some of these complex questions, at which he just takes one chapter to discuss this. He talks about many, many other issues. He makes this comment, the brain cannot make you sin. Now, that is a bold statement. The brain cannot make you sin, whether it's Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, or whatever you want to put under those kind of psychological questions, hyperactivity. The brain cannot make you sin. Is it sin for the child to be looking out the window, even if you told them not to? Is it sin? Now, when I say sin, I'm not saying sin before an almighty God. I'm just using it as a moral term, morally wrong. See, if we can separate that as teachers, that versus lying and disobedience. One child I worked with extensively at one point in my life, I'll never forget this little scene. And to me, it's probably the best one to illustrate these boxes. So the mother, the situation I was in was with the family, the mother said, Bob, it was not Bob, close the door. Just ignored her. Kept playing. Bob, close the door. Ignored her. Dad, Bob won't close the door. Bob closes the door. I mean, quickly, just. Was that physical? I can't quite get it. If it was, that was spiritual. That was wrong for that child to disobey the mother. I believe that strongly. I don't say that with 1 week of observation. This was a lot broader than that. It was wrong. That child disobeyed. Now, might that child be treated differently in terms of the severity of the discipline versus a child who is being obviously just boldly brash and disobedient? I think those things are cushioned. There's more work with that child, but there's consequences, and the child is responsible for not closing the door. The child is responsible. Now, when that child is ripping around and hyperactive and just kind of bouncing off the walls, now we're moving more to the physical, aren't we? And this does blur a little bit because a child who runs through the hallway at school and is told not to run through the hallway, that is a physical activity, ripping through the hallway. But it does move a little more to a moral issue when you told them not to 50 times. Now they are disobeying, right? But you understand there's a little crisscross there when we try to control the physical and they violate it. Well, now suddenly it slides it into an additional camp. Another little thing that happened one time in working with a child, I stepped around a corner and this little boy just had this look on his face, just kind of a, like, hi, teacher. What are you doing? Nothing. Well, I noticed. I think I maybe saw a little bit of the slide. What's in your hand? A cracker. Or pretzel. Pretzel. Where'd you get that? On the floor? No, on the floor. So you just picked it up, huh? What were you going to do with it? I was going to give it to you. I wanted to hug him. But I didn't know that I should. So quickly just lied. I was suspicious that I wonder if at home he's packing things up because of his past. And he was. Yep, his bedroom, stashes of food. Well, you can imagine, okay? History behind, difficulty, that child, what he went through. So you see something, you get it. I mean, I might need it. I might have found a pretzel. You don't let a pretzel there. But I was going to give it to the principal. See, I knew better. Is that lie different than a person who just blatantly lied over something else? I'm going to say yes. It is different, but it's still wrong. It's still wrong. But would I handle that different than at home with my child who did something obviously wrong and lied about it? I would handle it different. Number one, it's not my child. Number two, there's a context here to try to understand what's going on. And this child would fit this category times 10. For real. So was the picking up wrong? Is the fidgeting wrong? Where did it become wrong? What did we do with it? Again, compartmentalizing, I think, is so important. Between this is wrong, and take time to work through that with your principal and with the parents. What behaviors are actually wrong and are worth energy and time to discipline, and which things are not? And we'll look at some of those as we go. Yes, hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you know a child has a problem with saying that, is there a place for making it easier not to move in spiritual by not trying to control those things so much?
Okay.
Not creating the opportunity or the temptation.
Very, very good question. Some of this depends what you as a teacher can handle. What you can ignore and teach the other students to ignore. You know, to finally go to that child, that 8-year-old boy or girl, and just say, now, you may not tap your foot anymore. You just may, because other people look, and that's distracting. And by the way, it really works on my nerves. Well, they're going to tap their foot. Or they're going to. You may not look out that window one more time. If you look out that window one more time, I'm going to smack your hands. They're going to look out the window. You're right. You created the opportunity. So, wow. Do you have an answer? It's a very fair question. We as teachers need to find a look and say, at what point does this create a scenario in which we can hardly work with? But maybe the best is not to make a rule about it with consequences, but maybe a positive thing of, I'm going to keep track. See if you can get this down. See if you can just do it once or twice, maybe. Or can you get this thing down for me? It would really help me out. Rather than if you do that every time I see you, you're going to lose a minute of recess. Now, is there a place to ever do that? There is. I mean, we had a student that we really had to work with. I mean, this was just, I guess the student adored the teacher. And there was an incredible amount of time just spent, just turned around. I said, boy, I said, your student, he must love you. There was a place to say, you know what, we're going to have to keep some track of this. We're going to have to stand at recess. That's different maybe than a spanking or a huge consequence. Because we are working at disciplining the physical as well. But in a different, in a slower pace for one thing. And probably in a different way, more of an encouragement, smaller consequences than when it's strictly moral. I'm glad you asked that question because I in no way want to suggest that you just ignore those entirely. It can be hugely distracting. That is certainly true and can make it that you can hardly work. And we'll just look at a few of those things here coming up. Are there any other questions? Yes. Okay, and who might bring that question up? That's a very good question. Who might bring that up, would you say?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, good question. What do you do when one parent... Yes, I'll repeat the question. What do you do when one child you're being patient with because you believe there's these components of special challenges and you're being patient, and another child who seems fully responsible for what they are doing all in at a different level, and then you have a parent saying, well, you're always picking on my child, but he over there, he clicks his pen all the time, or he flicked something over and you just kind of left it go or said, don't do that, but my child, there was consequences right away. You know, if you can go to that parent and just say, I want to be fair, rather than defend yourself, I want to be fair. Maybe I wasn't fair. I'm trying to find my way. Maybe you can help me with this. I'm trying to find my way in this, and being fair with your child and this child. It does seem like this child has some needs that your child doesn't. That'll feel pretty good. and I'm being pretty patient with them, and maybe I'm being too patient. But, yeah, thank you for that. I do want to be consistent with, at the same time, understanding the context in which these difficulties are happening. I mean, that doesn't catch at all, I know. But trying to help the parent understand that you do want to be fair so that the child doesn't come back to school with a bad attitude, because that can happen. If the parent says, yeah, you know what, I'll call the teacher about that. That doesn't sound right. Versus saying, well, that's not even reasonable. You know that you knew better than that. She's trying to help him with some things. I'm sure she's doing a good job. That's just how it looks to you. There was no reason for that behavior. Whew. That'll change a child's attitude quickly. You know, what a challenge, though. You're right. All right, so we're trying to separate between physical issues and spiritual issues. Now, let's move into that in practical consideration to wrap this up, which, again, I know you wanted 20 things to do to take care of your problems. But as you know, it's the ADHD question, and there just is not ways that this will take care of the problem and it's going to go away. Rather, I'd like to give you a context in which to grapple through these. So the first point is to separate between the physical and spiritual. And I know I've said that many times, but we'll move on here. And I want you to think about the emotional factor, and some of this came up already. You need to separate, honestly as you can, between the physical and the spiritual and physical, and try to take your emotions out of this. In other words, you can be motivated by, I am sick and tired of this. This hassle is driving me nuts, and it's got to change. Be careful. Try to step back and emotionally detach. Don't draw these boxes and fill it in at 3 o'clock. Do it on the weekend when you can think and pray and ask God to help you to understand this child. Learn to love that child and try to write down what are physical things and spiritual, and try to get your emotions pulled away enough. But be honest enough that if you cannot run classes like this, then you need to do something with it, and we'll look at those points as we go. Secondly, or B, communicate with parents and the principal to set goals and expectations. I cannot overemphasize this one. Listen, don't do this by yourself. I have no idea with what situations you're working with. You might think you're making it sound terrible, or you might be saying, wow, it's 10 times worse than what you're saying. I mean, we just got such a range of children in our schools. But I want to encourage you to not slug this one out. Work with other people. Work with the parents. Sit down with the parents. We've needed to do that. That's a wonderful thing to do as a teacher, principal, and parents, and say, what are the goals for this child? What shall we do? Look, this happened. Okay, we cannot tolerate this line. I mean, we're going to have to do something about it. Okay, are we going to spank him every time? No, okay, maybe not, but boy, we got to do something here. You got to work that out with the parents and principal. But that just relieves your mind. So you don't feel stuck with the situation, because it's one of the fastest ways to burn out as a teacher, right? Is to be stuck with a difficult situation. You're not sure if the principal's happy with you, and you're not sure if the parent's happy with you, and you're just trying to find your way in the middle of this thing. You'll burn out quickly, because finally, you're just the teacher, and you feel pretty insecure if you're not getting that input. So insist on that input. Could we sit down and talk about this? There's so many things happening today. I want to give examples of what happened and have you help me understand what I should have done. That's a wonderful thing to do. And in other words, you're kind of throwing it back on the parents and principal or board administration to say, what should I do in these situations? Rather than, well, I just make the judgment call every time. Don't take that much upon yourself. Thirdly, remind often of the expectations and affirm the good you see. Remind the child often. What do you expect? Maybe at the beginning of the day, maybe you could stop that child and say, okay, you know, yesterday you turned around and looked at the teacher 20 times, right? Uh-huh. And you know, you stayed in for some recess, right? Uh-huh. Okay, well, you know, I'd love if we could do better than that today. Maybe this is just calling the child back to your desk in the lower grades, saying, what can we do about this today? See, they forgot about what happened yesterday, possibly. And this is a new day. And suddenly, wham, I'm in trouble again. Oh, that's right. This happened yesterday. If you take the initiative to remind them, okay, I'm going to be back here now. We got study hall for 20 minutes. I don't want you to be distracted. Or can you try it today? Keep your ruler where it belongs in your eraser. Yesterday you played with it a lot and you soon had crumbs all over the place and you know, the floor was a mess. We cleaned it up at recess, right? Well, today let's not pick that eraser apart. I mean, come on, let's keep on. And there's millions of things that happen, I know. Focus on one thing or two things for the day. I'll just throw that in here. Don't overwhelm the child with, and remember, don't be tapping your finger, and don't be looking back at that girl so much. When a truck goes by, don't be looking out the window, and remember, don't make extra marks on your paper, because then one or two things that child can focus on for the day, and then compliment them. Oh, that big smile. I'll tell you what, they can give huge smiles, can't they? You know, these children have some good things about them. They love to please, because you know what? They hear a lot about don't. They're used to that. And some of them at home have a lot of negative pressure because the parents are highly embarrassed of the behavior of their child. Whew, you've probably seen that. And so school, to try to create a place where the child feels loved and appreciate it when they do what is right, and be quick to compliment them. Just pull them aside and just say, wow, you did great. It was only a few times. That's a big improvement. But be ready, the afternoon might not go so well. And the next day, this thing goes up and down and up and down all year long. I'm sorry it does. But hopefully the downs aren't quite as low. And hopefully the ups are a little better. And the path does move upward. But remember, the good days and the bad days will continue to happen all year long, I'm afraid. Eliminate distractions when possible. This can be difficult as you move into the middle grades and you feel very conscious of the child feeling shamed. And I want to caution you with that. There's a student in another school that I just was involved with a little bit, and as I talked to the school, I really grappled. And this was recently, so these things are still done. I really grappled with the fact that this boy in sixth, seventh grade was in a cardboard box in the corner of the classroom. Now, maybe that has worked effectively, but I'm just going to caution with that kind of thing. And so I heard stories of people who would visit, and they would walk in, and sure enough, he would look out of the cardboard box. Why would too? I mean, why not? See who's here. You know, and then you go back into your little cardboard box. Because he was so distracting to the other students, and he couldn't handle the distractions around him. And as I got to know the boy a little bit, and did a few things with them, what a hurting boy. I think the boy felt stupid. And he did act stupid sometimes. He did. He did do things that didn't work. I don't know the answer to all of that. Remove distractions. That child can be in the front of the room instead of the back, and you know what? Maybe never get to the back. Talk to them about it. Talk to the parents. How would you feel if it just doesn't work in the back? I need him close to my desk. Is that okay? I'm not doing it to make him look stupid. Work through those kind of distractions. Maybe the flow of traffic needs to go another way because every time the traffic goes by him, he, you know, does something or distracts him. Okay, let's just go. You know, children, let's just go back this way, back to my desk, okay? Just this way. You don't have to say why. There's just a million little things, or at least 1,000 little things, to try to think about is what is causing the distraction and what can be eliminated. I mean, do they need 5 pens on top of their desk? Do they need 5 pencils so that they can snap one at a time, you know, until they're down to the last one? But just have one and then, or two or whatever. Just look for ways to minimize those distractions without shaming the child. I know sometimes it seems like the child is responsible for this bizarre behavior and they ought to really feel stupid. But work through it carefully. I just work through it carefully. I guess I get pretty concerned when it gets to those extremes. Last of all, and that is that the student may need to be removed for the good of everyone from the classroom. That can happen. That has happened in our situation at school through the years. This boy eventually that I was talking about, although it was not in our school, was eventually removed from the school. There are cases where simply the emotional pressure is great enough for you as a teacher that the child does need to be removed. Think through that carefully with your principal and your board. Make sure you don't reflect the attitude of, oh, what peace. I mean, whew, this is wonderful. The child's no longer there. That may be to a close friend or your parent or a co-teacher, but boy, oh boy, don't let that leak out into the community. Oh, school's going great now. Church, how's school going? Oh, so good. Ever since so-and-so is in my room, oh, it's just like peace. Oh, you're going to hurt people. I do believe there's times where a child needs to be removed. It's intense enough for the good of you and that child and everybody else. You know, we can get fixated on one child's problem, and I just want to mention that. We can be fixated on this one child, and that's all we think about when we go home, this one child. How can I help them? How can I help them? And I don't want to be a failure by having them removed from the classroom because, you know, I should be able to pull this off. Make sure you're motivated by what is best for the student. What is best for the class. And also at times, what can I emotionally handle? I just cannot go on like this. It doesn't work. My focus is just on this child throughout the day. Everybody else feels neglected. Parents feel like their child is neglected because all the energy goes to this child. There are times where removing the child does need to happen. Don't take it personal. Don't feel like a failure. But also be careful we don't rush to that conclusion because it is a hugely visible thing to the class and to the community, to the parents, and a very, very difficult thing. We've tried to work through that already in a situation, and yes, the parents they agreed, but it was a huge shame for them that their child couldn't be in the classroom because they were so bad, as of course people would think. Are there any questions? It's time to close here. Give you a 15-minute break. Well, go ahead. Okay.
And I'm not a teacher, but I work enough with kids that it helps them feel respected in a sense that doesn't make them feel so much a victim of their own behavior.
Okay.
For them to sort of tell you. The older ones especially know more than we sometimes give credit because they act like little animals. Mm-hmm. Sorry. And they actually do know and feel helplessness themselves.
Okay. And pretty tough. Thank you. I appreciate that. As they get older, to as you talk to that child, to have them give what helps them. What are some things they need to work on? What are some goals? Makes them feel respected and gives you a wonderful opportunity to go back to the child then and say, you know what? You are really doing better in that. And just to feed that positive dimension as you work through those difficulties is so important because emotional burnout can happen in these cases. Any other questions? Again, this is a question that will never go away. But I would encourage you to, again, trust the parents' judgment as you can. Allow them to help make some of those tough questions about Ritalin, etc. Try to compartmentalize the behaviors because we cannot fully compartmentalize the reasons, but the behaviors. Put them in boxes and try to work with them accordingly. May God bless you. Remember, these children will grow up to be adults. And one day you will look them in the eyes. And that is a sobering thing. I've taught long enough that I have what I call grand students in our school. Ere long I may teach them. And, you just think back through of how did I really treat them and what were my attitudes? And that might be some negative motivation, but it can also be positive motivation to treat people with respect. They are God's creation, even with the problems that they bring. Thank you for your attention.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.